We've been suggesting since the beginning that one of Nietzsche's primary campaigns is the campaign against morality. But we've never really said what morality is and what it is such that Nietzsche is so against it, except for the rather vague statement that he's against life-denying values. Maybe we should begin at this point by distinguishing between morality in one sense and morality in another sense. In print, I guess the way you would do it would be to capitalize the first and use small letters for the second. The second, morality, is prone to the plural. Different societies have different moralities. Perhaps even different individuals have different moralities. We today are very fond of talking about things, for example, our personal values or my personal morality. And in that sense, one might say there are moralities of all different kinds, and one does more anthropology and looks around the world, one finds more and more interesting variations. In that sense, one might say everyone has a morality, and some of these moralities may be more effective than others. According to our perspective, some of these moralities may be more acceptable than others, but in a way it's a very innocent notion. What it is to say is that to have a morality is simply to have some rank order of values. Some things are good, some things are better than good, some things are bad, and some things are even worse than bad. Morality in the first sense, morality with a capital M, that's morality as a singular. It has no plural. It is what people often talk about when they talk about morality. Morality says that. Morality dictates that. It is immoral, now I suppose with a capital M, to do certain sorts of things. It's a non-negotiable judgment. It isn't simply subject to the particularities of a culture, or it's certainly not personal. It is something objective. It is something writ large. So what Nietzsche is going to attack, now to put it rather succinctly, is the first kind of morality, morality with a capital M, morality as something singular, morality as something objective and writ large. What he will not attack at all is moralities with a small m, quite to the contrary. He wants to say that human moralities in that sense are what's essential to being human. It is part of our nature to value and to order values. What's more, it's not simply human nature that follows this. One can find it, for example, throughout the animal kingdom. In the higher animals, those that have something that I think we could call full consciousness and social relationships, if you look at wolves, for example, in a pack, or even just a group of dogs in the neighborhood, it's very clear that they have this running dialogue in which they establish who's the boss, who's going to follow, who does what. And in some animals, of course, this can be very sophisticated indeed. I think probably all animals, at least after a certain level, develop a certain sense of taste. There's some foods that they find delectable. There's some foods that they find merely edible. There are some that they will eat only in starvation conditions, and other things they won't eat at all. The idea of talking about values here may seem a bit far-fetched from the human perspective, but one of the things that Nietzsche wants to do, as always, is he wants to bring it down to nature. He wants to be a naturalist. He wants to talk about people and their values and their behavior with the Darwinian thesis in mind, that we are animals. And the fact that we also reflect on values, that we have notions of evaluation, is something interesting and important about us. But there's a sense in which it rides on top of a more basic sense of value. And when we talk about a culture's morality with a small m, what we're talking about is really that basic sense of value. Their tastes, their prejudices, their notion of taboo, some of which may in fact never be articulated, and in fact in every society there are going to be certain values which are never mentioned at all. In fact, people would even be surprised if you said, "Do you realize how much you value this? Look at your behavior, and it's obvious that you do," but they themselves might not immediately see it. Now, this all raises a number of fascinating questions, something philosophers have debated for many years. One is about the nature of values themselves. One of Nietzsche's pithier, more straightforward pronouncements on this, which echoes in a way his statement about science and truth when he says, there are no facts, only interpretations. What he says is, there are no moral facts. And then he says something that rubs a little bit against the other one, where he says there are only moral interpretations of facts. But the idea is that values are not facts in the world. And if one appeals to a sense of morality in which these are supposed to be objective, for example, God-given commandments, or even facts about human nature, one is always going to be, in some sense, subverting oneself, because the truth is, that's not the nature of values. On the one hand, values aren't simply in the world. But at the same time, Nietzsche would be the first to reject what lots of people today, and certainly a good many of our undergraduates, believe, and that is that values are subjective. They are personal. Each person, in some sense, imposes his or her own values on the world. And this is part of the notion of having your personal values or having a personal morality. But the truth is more complicated, and I think Nietzsche is one of the first philosophers to see through the distinction very clearly. There's been a whole movement in philosophy, and one could argue this goes back to Plato. But it's an argument about whether, as I just put it, whether values are in the world or they're in us. Nietzsche's view is that this doesn't make much sense. Now, Nietzsche, remember, is always a pragmatic philosopher. He's someone who thinks in practical terms. The question for him is, does this view, does this question, does this enhance life or not? Is it relevant to life or not? I think the definitive answer to this objective-subjective question comes from the great Scottish philosopher David Hume, a century or so before Nietzsche. What Hume argued was what was then the very voguish argument, that values are a lot like colors. And as other psychologists, philosophers had argued, John Locke in particular, colors could be argued not to be in the world, not properties of things, but rather colors are in our minds. There are properties of things that cause our minds to see colors, but if you were to ask the question, where is red? The red isn't in the apple. The red is in my mind, caused by the apple. Hume says, so too. Things don't have values. But seeing things causes in us evaluations. And so Hume's answer to this was that the values are in us, not in the world. So far, Nietzsche would disagree. But Hume's conclusion, I think, is very telling. And it's a shame that a great many philosophers who write whole books on the subject now didn't pay it enough attention. Hume says, it may be that colors are in the mind and not in the world. But if you're decorating your apartment, that distinction makes no difference to you. So too, when we're worried about values, morality, human behavior, the question whether values are in us or in the world is of no interest whatsoever. Hume, the great skeptic, was perfectly capable of drawing all sorts of difficulties out of the most ordinary phenomena. But when it came down to the end of it, he was always ready to say, well, so much for philosophy, that was a lot of fun, now let's get back to living. And of course, Nietzsche picks him up right at that last line and says, the rest is all just fiddle-faddle. What we're interested in is what's valuable for life, and the truth is, we experience the world in value-loaded terms, and there is no way we can get behind that or beyond that. We are stuck with values. That's what makes us who we are. It is not a question of whether it's objective or subjective. It's a question of what are the values, how do we negotiate them, given that people have different ways of seeing the world. Now, that is, of course, specific to species as well as to individual human beings and human groups. If you think, for example, about what some bugs find most valuable in the world, it probably makes most of us pretty nauseous. If you look at even your pet dog or cat, as delightful as I'm sure he or she is, they have tastes and desires which we find utterly repulsive. Nevertheless, we recognize in ourselves certain peculiarities of the human species. And part of the genius of Nietzsche, of course, is the fact that he describes these with such great anthropological detail that we are sort of taken back by our own behavior and say, yeah, that's what we do, and I never realized it before. And as I said, of course, values are culture-specific. You don't have to travel very far. In fact, very often, just down a couple of blocks in your hometown to see that different groups value different things. Different groups have different senses of morality. And of course, one of the perennial battles in the United States is always which of these different specific moralities, in the plural, are we going to accept as a morality singular with a capital M binding on everyone? And Nietzsche, of course, would be first in line to say that second notion of morality, the morality with a capital M binding on all of us, that's what we have to reject, and that's what his philosophy is aimed at. This means, of course, that one of the things we have to reject is the idea that values were given to us by God. Perhaps the clearest example of what I'm calling morality with a capital M, the morality that is Nietzsche's target, is the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue from the Old Testament. If you think about those commandments, there are a number of specific issues that become obvious. The first is, and probably the most important, is that they were given to us by God. Although perhaps given to us is the wrong verb here, they were imposed on us by God. God did not say to Moses up on Mount Sinai, would you like some advice or would you like some commandments? God simply gave them to Moses. And it was very clearly a straightforward imperative, take these and obey them. And Moses then, of course, took the commandments down the hill and gave them to his people, who were not particularly receptive at the time. If you think about that picture then, something else comes to mind, and it's not just a question of God giving us the commandments, but it's also a notion of the commandments being handed down from above. In other words, they're not our commandments, they are given to us. They are imposed on us. And like a child who is commanded by his or her parents not to do something, our natural response might well be, as the Hebrews at the bottom of the mountain displayed, our reaction might well be, why should we do that? Why should we believe that? There's a sense in which the values come from the outside. They are not natural. They don't come from us. And of course, because they're God-given, there is a good chance that they may be appropriate only for a God-like creature. Why should we suppose that they're appropriate for creatures like us? And of course, if you think about the Ten Commandments, something else becomes apparent. Most of the Ten Commandments, in fact, almost all of them, which are not in some sense religious commandments, almost all of them begin, thou shalt not. They are prohibitions. They put constraints on our behavior. Morality, consequently, comes to suggest to us not so much a way to behave, but a whole list of things that we should not do. We should not kill, we should not steal, we should not commit adultery. In fact, the only positive moral commandment, I would say, is the one that says, honor your father and thy mother. But the rest of them tell us what not to do. So there's a sense of morality as negative, as prohibitive. And if you look at how morality often works in everyday life, the sorts of things that people say about it, you find the word immorality probably occurring a lot more than you see the simple word morality. things are criticized for breaking those commandments more often than they are simply praised for obeying them. I mean, we don't go around giving medals to people for not killing people. We only go around giving jail sentences and worse to people who do. So there's a sense in which the whole picture of God-given morality is something Nietzsche wants to reject, not because of his atheism, and not because of other criticisms he has of Christianity and Judaism, but simply because the idea of an externally imposed value system is unnatural. And what we have to understand is morality, now with a small m, morality as something natural, morality that comes from us. The modern and most philosophical version of this concept of morality with a capital M is in Immanuel Kant, whom we've talked about now several times. But now I want to focus in on Kant as a specifically moral philosopher. As we've said, Kant says that morality really comes down to something he calls the moral law, which is characterized in turn by what he famously refers to as the categorical imperative. A categorical imperative, it's first of all a command, as the Ten Commandments are, but secondly, it is categorical in the sense that it is absolutely unexceptional, that it simply says, thou shalt. It doesn't say, by contrast, if thou once such and such, then do such and such. If you don't want to get in trouble with the law, then don't kill. If you don't want to have terrible neighborhood relations, then don't commit adultery with your neighbor, and so on. It says simply, don't do these things. Kant formalizes the categorical imperative in a number of different ways. He refers to them as different formulations of the categorical imperative, and scholars differ on exactly how many of these there are because Kant doesn't actually number them. But what's important is that it is always the categorical imperative he refers to, and it's quite clear that he, much like the Ten Commandments, has in mind a singular system of morality. Morality is one set of commandments, and ultimately, one might even say, it is one commandment with different formulations. The first formulation of the categorical imperative is actually very instructive. It's by far the most famous. It says, basically, act so that the maxim of your action, in other words, the principle upon which you personally are acting, your intention in some sense, act so that the maxim of your action you would will as a universal law for all humanity. A nice, simple way of putting this is in terms of some grandmotherly advice. When you do something, ask the question, what if everyone did that? Because the intention Kant gives us, using the categorical, is what he sometimes refers to as a test of moral propositions. The idea is that you ask yourself, is this something that I would do if I were you? Or is it something I would have you do if you were me? Or what if I were to say, as I'm considering, for example, stealing a book from the library, what if everyone were to steal books from the library? And the answer, of course, is if everyone were to steal books from the library, there would be no library books left. There would be no libraries. And Kant's rather convoluted but very sophisticated notion here is that when you universalize in that way, what you're doing, first of all, is you are taking morality out of the realm of mere experience. That is, taking morality away from, for example, the idea that it is simply a cultural tradition, or it is something that you've learned over time, or it is something that you've calculated as a utilitarian would in terms of its consequences. And what you've done instead is you've now thought of morality as a product of pure practical reason. It is a rational phenomenon, not an experiential one. And with that, something else happens too. Because as you universalize as a test of morality, what you find is that you have now applied in exactly the same way, the same rules, the same laws, to every single person. By removing it from the realm of experience and the realm of particular experience and the realm of particular cultural experience, it now becomes a rule for everyone. But this actually doesn't always work. Because the truth is, the idea that if you apply the rule equally to everyone, that you're thereby being fair, and everyone has the same advantages and disadvantages. We talk in business, for example, about a level playing field. But the truth is that applying the same rule to everyone almost always benefits some people and harms others. Let me give you a nice down-home example. When I have to grade my students, something I don't particularly enjoy doing, I love teaching them, but grading them, not really. Criticizing them, sure, but not grading. So anyway, I sometimes have a discussion with them about how they would be graded. And we talk about this for a while, and they all agree that they should be treated the same. And I say, okay, how about if I give you all C's? And they all, of course, make these rude noises that undergraduates make. And I retract, and I say, okay, how about if I give you all B's? And at that, most of them are pleased, since that's the best they would expect in the class anyway. And then just to vary the experiment, I say, well, what if I gave you all A's? And of course, they cheer and make all these also undergraduate noises. But when I finish, one student or two students at the front of the class usually will raise a hand and say, but that's not fair. Why isn't it fair? Everybody's getting the best grade. Well, the truth is that it doesn't mean anything. We students who really work hard for the A are being cheated. And of course, the same is true of any grade that I give them. Now, of course, one can make this much more sophisticated, as I do as the discussion goes on, and start talking about, okay, grading people on their merits, on their work, on their effort, and so on. But it seems that whatever we choose, there's always going to be some people who are benefited and other people who are disadvantaged. So the notion of universalization, which is at the heart of Kant's philosophy, ultimately isn't quite as fair as he wants it to be. And most important for Nietzsche, what universalization, applying the same rule to everyone, does is it ignores or neglects or even destroys the exceptions. And what Nietzsche's interested in is always the exception. There's a sense in which we might say we're all exceptions. That's the kind of flattering way to put it. But Nietzsche, of course, is fairly clear that really in every generation, in every culture, there are only a few people who are really the pinnacle, the ones that make the whole culture, the whole life worthwhile. And that's what he's after. So the attack on morality, and the attack on Kant's morality in particular, which recurs over and over in Nietzsche's later works, the attack on Kant's morality is very much an attack on this notion of a singular, universalizable, rational, or God-given set of laws, or one law, which applies to everyone. What he wants to say instead is, we each have our own individual values, and those must be respected. Morality, with a small m, must come from within. And those are the values worth defending. The attack on nihilism is the attack on these externally imposed values. The attack, the defense of morality with a small m is ultimately a defense of life in all of its various forms. One of the things that gets thrown out in the Kantian emphasis on reason, as we've said in several lectures so far and will again, is the whole notion of the passions, the emotions, even desires, what Kant rather uniformly calls the inclinations. And what Kant wants, and what Nietzsche wants to say, of course, is that it's the inclinations which give us morality with a small m, not morality with a capital M, which is designed in Kant in particular as a purely rational enterprise. Now, what do the inclinations tell us? It would be a mistake to simply say, inclinations are good, reason is bad. That's stupid. Even David Hume, who actually held a line somewhat close to this, said that ethics isn't based on reason. It's really and has to be based on the sentiments. But of course, not any sentiment will do. The sentiment of sympathy is one that he highlights, praises elaborately. But other sentiments, for example, resentment, something Nietzsche will talk a great deal about, doesn't get any praise at all. If you had to summarize what is essential to to those inclinations which are valuable to life. Nietzsche would say, basically, there are some that are healthy and there's some that are unhealthy. There are some that enhance life and there's some that are stupid and drag life down with their stupidity. The picture here is, once again, that rock-bottom value of all of Nietzsche's work, and that is that life itself is the value. And instead of thinking of life as a singular thing, life is, by its very nature, myriad, confusing, all over the place. Like Darwin again, he is fully appreciative of the diversity of species, and he is also fully appreciative of the diversity of human types and human beings. So the idea is that the defense of life is really a defense of that kind of diversity, and in the individual in particular, it is a defense of vitality. And so the health, sickness, metaphors permeate Nietzsche's philosophy precisely because instead of a morality of reason, a morality of law, a morality of external imposition, Nietzsche takes what is most in us and most obvious as, you might call it, a symptomatology of ethics. And that is this a healthy way to think? Is this a healthy set of values to have? Or is it a sick set of values to have? Is it make life less worth living? Does it drag life down? Now, there are many different things to say here about what constitutes health and sickness. But the first thing to say, something we have said before but we haven't really emphasized, is what Nietzsche's own life looked like. Nietzsche was sick all the way through his adult life. Even before his final collapse in 89 and his 10, 11 years of really pathetic vegetative existence, during his mature and most productive years, he was always plagued by all these horrible physical illnesses, such that, for example, he couldn't read himself. He often had to be read to. He couldn't write himself. He had to dictate many of his works. So this is a man who was always fighting with the issues of health and illness. And people say Nietzsche doesn't give much concrete advice. The truth is he gives an embarrassing amount of concrete advice. Everything from sort of nutritional advice to advice on how to help you sleep better and so on. All sorts of things. But health and illness were always on his mind. So if life is the ultimate value, then health and illness, for him, were the kind of diagnostic tools. Is this a healthy life or an unhealthy one? And what he says basically is that externally imposed values, things that you have to do but may be impossible for you or are God-given and consequently possibly God-like and don't fit our human constitution, that is unhealthy. Part of the problem with asceticism, as Kathy talked about it in the last lecture, is precisely the fact that asceticism as such isn't natural. It is life-denying, even if, in turn, on analysis, it turns out to be that it is life-asserting, power-asserting, in a very devious, roundabout way. Rational universal principles are also sickly, because rational principles are externally imposed. Now, that doesn't sound right, because Kant makes it sound as if reason is a faculty of the human mind, the individual mind, and even though it is the individual who thinks about it, it's universal principles that are at stake, or putting it the other way around, even if reason is universal in one sense, it is still something we do as individuals. Nevertheless, reason is opposed to nature. Reason in the sense that Kant uses it is something that is not just a natural faculty, but rather it imports considerations which are not instinctual, not internal, not essential to our individual well-being. Nietzsche attacks also the whole of what has come to be called modernity. And I just want to list very quickly a number of targets, some of which we've discussed before. One is democracy, and another is socialism, both very powerful influences in Nietzsche's time. And you don't want to say he simply rejects them, but democracy, he saw as Socrates, also tends to be a leveling device, like the grades I give to my students. It helps many, but there are always some, the most excellent, assertive, creative people whom it hurts. And so too with socialism. Egalitarianism, same argument. And I think he would add today, American consumerism. In a way, it makes us all equal insofar as we have spending power, but it also vulgarizes us. It removes any sense of value other than market value. And so too mass entertainment. What mass entertainment does is it plays to the lowest common denominator, an argument which was made by Plato as well.